listening to Football in Europe, the weekly podcast covering the game across the continent.
Thanks for downloading the show. I'm Rob Daly. This week, El Clasico. Zinedine Zidane's men win at the Camp Nou. We speak to Real Madrid TV's Phil Kitchmalidis about the victory on a night when Barcelona paid tribute to Johan Cruyff. We'll hear from Dutch football journalist Derek Brookman as well, in a profile of Cruyff and his legacy too. Cesare Maldini dies at the age of 84. Meanwhile, in Italy, Napoli drop points in the title race as Gonzalo Higuain sees red in every sense of the word. Plus, ITV Bundesliga commentator Mark Scott is here to talk Bayern, Goethe to Liverpool, and why Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang is the subject of a hip-hop song you might wish you'd never heard.
This is Football in Europe.
Well, that's the sound of El Cant del Barça, the famous club anthem of FC Barcelona, sung before every home game at the Camp Nou. Very kindly recorded for us at Saturday's game by La Liga Gav, one of our best contributors to the show. There is no Chris Parrott this week, but helping us to get the podcast underway is Real Madrid TV's Phil Kitchmalidis. Phil, thanks a lot for coming on the podcast today.
Absolute pleasure. Thanks for having me, Rob.
So before we get into the fact that Real Madrid actually went and won that game, people would have seen the wonderful mosaic for Johan Cruyff ahead of kickoff. I mean, it was truly special.
It was special. It was very emotive. It was always going to be a very emotive evening for fans of Barcelona and anyone associated with the club, but also, I mean, general footballing fans. I think the outpouring of grief across Europe for Johan Cruyff with his passing was testament really to the profound effect that he had on football across the whole world, really, and especially in Europe. So yeah, it was pretty special. It was very emotive. There were tears shed in the Camp Nou by certain fans, and a fitting tribute, I think.
Yeah, we'll have a profile on Johan Cruyff later on in the show. Phil, given the fact that Barcelona did beat Real Madrid 4-0 at the Bernabeu earlier in the season, how important to the players do you think it was to get a 2-1 victory in Barcelona on Saturday night?
It was important for absolutely everyone involved with Real Madrid for Real Madrid to get that win. The 4-0 defeat at the Bernabeu back in November was one of the worst evenings in recent history for Real Madrid. Not only the result, but the image shown by the team. They were just so spectacularly poor that it really did quite a lot of damage to the image of the side. It did a lot of damage to Rafa Benitez, and ultimately, I suppose, it was very difficult for him to come back from that result and that performance. So it was absolutely vital for morale rather than anything for Real Madrid to get this win, because realistically speaking, 7 points behind Barcelona, which is effectively 8 because Barcelona has the superior head-to-head advantage, which is how things are settled here. Instead of goal difference, it's 11 on points. So effectively, Barcelona are 8 points clear with 7 games to go. It's unlikely that they're going to drop sufficient points for Real Madrid to win the league. So this was more about morale. It was more about giving something back to the fans, and it can be important. Of course, going to Wolfsburg on Tuesday for the game on Wednesday, I think the players have admitted that the Champions League is very much their focus now. So this can be a catalyst for Real Madrid, not necessarily for La Liga, but for what remains of a European campaign. It will also send a message out as well. Before, I think certain European sides would have been thinking, actually, we don't mind too much if we draw Real Madrid in the Champions League. Now they will have seen that result. They will have seen particularly the second half performance, and in particular the last 15 minutes where they were rampant against Barcelona, and thought, actually, hold on, this is still Real Madrid, and they might be quite tricky. So it was very, very important for Real Madrid on a number of levels.
And they did it after, I mean, fundamentally got the win after Sergio Ramos was sent off again for the club.
Again, yeah, no one has ever been sent off more times in La Liga history than in Sergio Ramos. It wasn't necessarily too much of a surprise, particularly when he picked up a yellow card inside the first 10 minutes for dissent. You kind of knew what might be coming. He joked afterwards that, well, if I'd known that we were going to go on and win, I would have got myself sent off a lot earlier in the game. they got him out of trouble a little bit because it was a bit of a rash challenge, the second challenge, which got him sent off. But it was very, very impressive, actually, Real Madrid, because it went down to 10 men. They just had a perfectly good goal ruled out, and I don't think that's my Real Madrid TV bias coming through. I think it was pretty generally widely accepted that Carvajal's goal should have stood. It didn't. That was ruled out, and then 30 seconds later, Sergio Ramos gets sent off, and I think Real Madrid fans around the world were thinking, right, okay, well, we're definitely not going to get anything out of this game, and we might even go on to lose it. But they kept going at Barcelona, and Ronaldo then hit the crossbar. Bale had another chance before Ronaldo then scored. So, yeah, in spite of Sergio Ramos's his red card, they got the win, which makes it even more impressive, I guess.
Yeah, I'd echo your thoughts on the Gareth Bale goal. I think that should have stood. And from what I saw of the game, Barcelona's front three looked decidedly off. Would that be a fair thing to say?
Yeah, they did, surprisingly so. I mean, it could have been very, 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 very different had Luis Suarez buried more or less a sitter that he had in the first half. I'm not sure, still not sure how he missed it. The ball just got tangled up, I suppose, in his feet and he didn't bury it from about 6 yards out. If he'd scored, that could have been very different. But, I mean, let's remember that all three of the MSN had been in South America playing a World Cup qualifier for their international teams. And while Neymar got himself a yellow card in the first of Brazil's games, which ruled him out of the second one, Messi and Suarez were involved. And it's a lot of travelling. It's a lot of emotional investment as well. So perhaps that was something to do with it, because they looked a little bit jaded. They looked a little bit off, as you said, a bit tired. They've also played 12 more games than Real Madrid this season. Of course, they're in the final of the Copa del Rey. They had the Club World Cup. They had the Spanish Super Cup right at the start of the season as well. So perhaps it's normal that there is a little bit of a dip physically from Barcelona. I mean, this is just one game, so let's see. But certainly in the last 15 minutes, Real Madrid looked a lot fitter, and they were running wild, and Barcelona couldn't really cope. And there was a big gap in the centre of midfield, which you don't often see with Barcelona. But you saw Toni Kroos and Modric and Marcelo charging through the centre of midfield, which I don't know if that has something to do with fitness or whether or not Barcelona just lost their shape, which I think was admitted by a couple of players. But yeah, they were a little bit off the front three, surprisingly so. And now they'll try and get back to scoring ways against Atletico on Tuesday, which is an absolutely massive game.
I mean, is there any risk that the result and the nature of the defeat in the end could derail Barcelona's season? Perhaps not in defending La Liga, but certainly in defending the Champions League.
Maybe. I mean, let's not get carried away. They've lost one game in 5 months. I mean, it was the first defeat in 40, so they're still doing all right. That defeat came in the most high-profile game in the world, so obviously everybody was watching and everyone saw them lose. And emotionally, it has an impact as well. This is the one game that Barcelona want to win more than any other, even if they've more or less got La Liga sewn up. It doesn't matter. You still want to beat Real Madrid. And when you're leading at home against Real Madrid and then you somehow contrive to lose as well, that will hurt. So obviously Luis Enrique had a job to G up his players a little bit, which is why Tuesday night's game is very important against Atletico Madrid. Obviously, it's a big game. Obviously, it's a Champions League quarterfinal. But now there's a bit more emotional investment in it as well. And if, for whatever reason, there wasn't to be a good performance and indeed a favourable result for Barcelona, then some doubts might begin to creep in. They're away at Real Sociedad this weekend, which isn't necessarily easy. They don't have a particularly good record up at Anoeta. Real Sociedad coming off the back of a decent, very decent victory in Seville, stopping Seville's 17-match winning streak. So that's not going to be easy at all. So we're getting into an interesting period now for Barcelona. Obviously, they've got the players to deal with it. And you would think that they would beat Atletico Madrid and they would beat Real Sociedad and it should be okay. But if they weren't to put in a good performance and get a good result against Atletico, I really do think that there might be one or two question marks, a little bit of doubt beginning to creep in.
Before I ask you a couple on Gary Neville, Phil, as someone who sees Real Madrid week in, week out, I want to know if you're seeing any sense of identity to the Zidane Real Madrid. From what I've seen, I feel it's almost an amalgamation of Ancelotti and what Benitez were trying to achieve. Can you see a Zidane stamp on the Real Madrid team?
I think that's a relatively fair assessment, actually. He wants the team to play with possession as far as possible, but I think there was a realisation that on Saturday night you're not going to have possession against Barcelona, even if you are Real Madrid. So that was very much a more cautious, defensive, organised approach to the game, whatever you want to classify it. It wasn't necessarily the Real Madrid style. Obviously, Real Madrid want to play free-flowing, attacking football. Ancelotti said in his presentation when he arrived here, I want the team to play spectacular football. And at times, they really did. But there was an acknowledgement that Real Madrid, against some of the bigger teams, were found out under Ancelotti. So I think Benitez is brought in an attempt to try and infuse that idea of attacking free-flowing football with a bit more defensive solidity, organisation and balance. And obviously he wasn't able to get part of that right. So maybe Zidane can. It's difficult coming in halfway through a season as well, as Zidane has. He hasn't had a pre-season. He hasn't necessarily been able to bring in players that he wants. So I think it'll be more interesting, and we'll get a clearer idea maybe around this time next season what the Zidane style is, and we'll have had time to stamp his authority on the team.
Phil, let's talk Valencia, because since we did our last show, it was Gary Neville's been sacked as Valencia manager, and I heard you and Sid Lowe talking about it on your podcast, the Spanish Football Podcast, as well. Fundamentally, what do you think Gary Neville's big mistake was? Because some of the tweets from the likes of Stuart that we've had have been suggesting maybe taking the job in the first place might have been Neville's mistake.
Yeah, I think if we want to take it to the very fundamental, basic level, that probably was the mistake. Perhaps he underestimated the magnitude of the job. He underestimated the level of expectations at a club like Valencia, who arguably has the most demanding fan base in Spain, and I work for Real Madrid, so I'm telling you that is saying something. So, it was never, ever going to be easy. And what Gary Neville did wrong, well, he didn't win enough games. I mean, three wins out of 16 La Liga games is not good enough. They didn't keep a clean sheet in La Liga. The football was not good. He wasn't able to transmit whatever ideas he had. And I'm sure he had ideas, but for whatever reason, they weren't able to get across enough. There were some touches, some games they played quite well. When they went out of the Europa League to Athletic Bilbao, they won 2-1, but they went out on the away goals rule. And that was an excellent performance. But then in the next game in La Liga, they really, really dropped. And he wasn't able to get any sort of consistency. And it's strange because it's the same players that did for Nuno as well. More or less, broadly speaking, a similar group of players that got into the Champions League last season. So I think we have to blame them as well for simply not performing. But ultimately, Gary Neville will probably look back and think, maybe it wasn't the right choice going there in the first place.
And Phil, a final one. I'm looking at the table now. Valencia is 6 points above the drop zone. Is there any danger that they could go down, or do you think that they're safe?
No, yeah, there is definitely the danger that they could go down. They have to play Barcelona, they have to play Real Madrid, they have to play Villarreal. So that's three of the top four that they've still got to play in seven games. They're going away to Getafe, I think, as well, who are fighting for their lives. So I think at the time of recording today, we haven't had the last game in La Liga this weekend, which is Sporting against Levante. I think if Sporting win that one, then Valencia will be 5 points from the drop zone, so it's not looking particularly good. And I think that's why they pulled the trigger. That's why Gary Neville is gone, because they need some kind of reaction. I mean, the result this weekend at Las Palmas was absolutely disastrous, and Las Palmas themselves have actually been doing pretty well. 5 wins out of the last six, playing good football, and it's not a. I mean, you know, there's no disgrace, but really, it was a pretty bad result, especially as they'd gone ahead. And Valencia are in trouble. No two questions about it. They really are. And can you imagine if they go down? It would be utterly, utterly disastrous.
It would be truly bizarre. Phil, thank you so much for joining us on the podcast for the first time. If you want to hear Phil's show, where can you find the Spanish Football Podcast, Phil?
You can download it on iTunes, as I'm sure many of your listeners do as well, and on SoundCloud as well.
Phil, thank you very much. Coming up next, I speak to ITV Bundesliga commentator Mark Scott about the weekend's action in Germany.
This is Football in Europe, Bundesliga Roundup.
Mark, good to have you on the podcast again.
A pleasure as ever.
Yesterday you commentated on Bayern beating Frankfurt 1-0. Perhaps not the most convincing scoreline that you'd expect given Frankfurt are in the relegation zone.
No, it was a bit of a workmanlike performance from Bayern. Second consecutive game they've won by a goal to nil. They weren't at their flowing best, but Guardiola made quite a few changes, perhaps with Tuesday's Champions League game against Benfica in mind. They got the job done. Frankfurt didn't really have any chances. So even though it was only 1-0, it was a comfortable 1-0. They didn't really have to get out of second gear.
And interesting because Niko Kovac, he's the Frankfurt head coach now, and he had a connection with Bayern.
Yeah, him and his brother Robert Kovac, both former Bayern players. They won plenty of silverware during their time there in the early 2000s. And, you know, he went back there saying that they came to win. Didn't really look like that, to be honest. You know, he played five at the back in the second half, and it almost looked like they were happy to settle for 1-0 at the end, which is obviously quite a strange situation.
We've got to talk about the Frank Ribery goal, which was an extraordinary overhead kick. We'll tweet that out as well if people haven't seen it, but do you want to talk people through the goal?
Basically Goetze gets a surge through the centre. There's an unfortunate slip in the centre from one of the Frankfurt defenders. Goetze has a go at goal. Radetzky blocks it with his feet. The ball loops up to the edge of the penalty area and Ribery just flies through the air and executes a perfect bicycle kick, basically. Meaty contact right on the laces of the boot, and it just flies into the top corner. I think in the commentary I said you just can't budget for something like that happening. I couldn't obviously get the words out that I meant to say. I just, you can't legislate, I think is what I was trying to say.
No, budget's fine, I think. I think you got away with it.
There is no budgeting for something like that, but you know what I mean. If you see it, you just, you know, it's just one of those moments. And I haven't seen every goal this season, but it's got to be up there as a contender for goal of the season.
You've also seen a bit of Benfica this season. They play them in the Champions League, and you're reporting on that game this week. Well, do you expect that to be relatively routine for Bayern? Surely easier than the Juventus tie?
Yeah, you would have thought so. I mean, Benfica against Zenit didn't really impress me too much, and they only squeaked through, obviously, late on in the return leg. I think that, you know, he rested quite a few players. You know, Vidal and Douglas Costa both came on late on. So they were given a bit of a breather. Kimmich as well, the centre-back, was left on the bench, and Javi Martinez started for the first time in a long time at the back. So quite a lot of his big hitters will be fresh. The one thing surprised me a little bit is Lewandowski looked a bit off the pace against Frankfurt. Didn't really have his A game there, and that'll obviously be good news for Benfica if that happens again.
Yesterday I commentated on Hannover losing 3-0 at home to Hamburg, which effectively, it looks like Hannover are down and Hamburg are probably safe now. Let's turn our attention to Borussia Dortmund, because after we finished our games and eventually convened later, we managed to find a pub to watch Dortmund beat Werder Bremen 3-2. They left it late. It was an exciting game.
Yeah, you know, we had one eye on that, one eye on the Liverpool-Spurs game as well, both with exciting climaxes. But, I mean, I guess you just have to say great fighting spirit from Dortmund. You know, they've won games late on a few times, coming from behind to sort of snatch the points. And they had to, really. If they'd have dropped points there, then you'd have thought that Bayern probably are home and dry. They need to keep the pressure on them. And, you know, Aubameyang with a great finish. Ramos with a really brave header late on to win it for them. Defensively, you know, Werder aren't a great attacking force, but, you know, they looked a little bit nervous at the back when Werder came forward, so that might be a concern, especially, you know, for the Europa League game coming up against Liverpool, with the likes of Coutinho and Sturridge looking good. If they're struggling to keep Werder at bay, then they might have big problems against Liverpool.
There were some notable banners in the Bundesliga this weekend. One at Bayern about how they don't want Monday night games, and there was one at the Dortmund game about, regarding rumours that Mario Götze may go back to Borussia Dortmund. Dortmund, and I'm trying to think of a clean way to say this, but they don't want Mario Götze back, and they made that clear with a banner.
Yeah, they made it very clear that they wouldn't want him to be returning, and in no uncertain terms. And you know, it was interesting because he got his first start, I think it was of 2016,
oh, wow,
for Bayern. either his first or his second start for them of this calendar year. So, you know, that's led to a lot of talk about where his future lies. Pep Guardiola's been laying plenty of praise at his door, but obviously hasn't been picking him. So, you know, everyone suspects that he might be on his way. He scored for Germany recently as well, which brought it more into the spotlight. But I just wonder, with Guardiola actually going, if, you know, it's going to be all changed there. Maybe Ancelotti likes the look of him and he might become a, you know, more central figure, especially if some other players get shifted out. So, look, if Guardiola was still going to be there next season, then I think Kurtz is definitely gone. Probably Liverpool's more likely than Dortmund, given
you'd imagine they'd almost be, aside from Bayern and aside from him staying, that would be the most likely place, if he did leave, he'd end up.
Yeah, because I don't think the Liverpool fans are against him coming, whereas the Dortmund fans are pretty vehement about it. And Jurgen Klopp, obviously, there's that connection there with him as well. So that would make a nice fit, and I could see him fitting into that Liverpool team pretty well.
Speaking of Dortmund and Liverpool, they meet in the Europa League this week. It's the game that everyone's excited about. And we've been seeing it on the TVs everywhere, the adverts and the trailers for Dortmund-Liverpool. How do you see that one going? Because they both are in, you know, relatively good form, looking good at the moment.
Well, I mean, I predicted that the Tottenham-Dortmund game was going to be, you know, probably one of the best games in Europe this season, let alone just the Europa League. Obviously, Pochettino's selection meant that it wasn't quite a full-strength Spurs, but they won't have that issue with Liverpool. It should be excellent. Liverpool, although they're not challenging towards the top of the table, they're in recent weeks have impressed. You know, Coutinho's on fire at the moment. Under Klopp, obviously, they go for games. They're not going to turn up and try and play defensively. And obviously, if they take the game to Dortmund, that should make for an excellent evening of entertainment. And it will be intriguing, actually, because, you know, it'll be interesting to see how Aubameyang does. He was obviously excellent against Spurs. And, you know, how Klopp tries to sort of contain him. Because this week, Aubameyang's been saying that he owes Klopp a lot of credit because he actually turned him into a striker. Perhaps with that inside knowledge, he might be able to try and negate the power and the threat that that he poses. So that could be very interesting. And obviously, it's always funny when a coach takes on his former club. How much does he know about the players that are there? Right. How much can he play on that? Is it any use? It's intriguing. It's fascinating. There's a lot of hype about it. Sometimes it can get a bit much, but I think given the state of play, this is justified.
And finishing with Dortmund, there's one thing I want to show you, and that is this. It's a song about Aubameyang that's been produced by his brother, and it's a rap video, so I'm going to play it for you now. So, what are your impressions?
Well, I don't know what is more shocking, the dance moves or the lyrics. We're not sheikhs. Us, what we want to do is sign checks. I mean, doesn't even rhyme and barely makes sense. Obami bang bang. That is something that a commentator might well use at some point.
Absolutely.
Not looking at you or anything. And the dance moves are just remarkable. I don't really know what's going on in it. It's great entertainment. And it was funny that when we were watching the game in Germany on Saturday night, that when he celebrated and pulled out some of the dance moves, they actually showed the video of that rap video
to
sort of compare it and explain why on earth he was looking like such an idiot. But I think my favourite bit is just Marco Reus loitering in the background, because obviously he looks a lot like you. So next time you've got a baseball cap, if you put it on back to front and throw some shapes, then, you know.
They're done. The final lyrics here. Black and yellow, it's not Versace, Versace, Borussia Dortmund, golden watch, golden chain, golden ball, everything's golden, brother.
Yeah, speechless. You know, it makes my whole thing saying you can't budget for that look like, you know, sort of work of Shakespeare.
Mark, thanks for coming back on the podcast.
No worries.
Follow the Football in Europe account on Audioboom for the latest podcasts, interviews and special features.
OK, a couple of other stories of note from the weekend in the Bundesliga. Two big results in the race for Champions League football. Leverkusen beat Wolfsburg in the game labelled El Plastico. They won by 3-0, Roger Schmidt's side. And Borussia Mönchengladbach beat Hertha by 5-0. So big results there in the race for the top four. Thomas Schaaf has been sacked as Hannover since I recorded that with Mark. It's after he lost 10 of his 11 league games in charge. While Julian Nagelsmann, the 28-year-old head coach of Hoffenheim, has managed to pull them out of the relegation zone. They're up to 14th. I commentated on their dramatic 1-1 draw with Köln at the weekend, and they needed a goal in the 90th minute from Kevin Folland to earn that point, which moves them out of the relegation zone. A profile on Johan Cruyff to come up very shortly on the show. But first, some other headlines from the world of European football. Cesare Maldini, you may have seen this, has died at the age of 84. The father of Paolo won four titles at AC Milan as a player, and he won the European Cup too. He also managed AC Milan, went on to manage the club and the Italian national team. Gonzalo Higuain had to be restrained by teammates in Serie A, meanwhile, after he was furious at being sent off in Napoli's 3-1 loss to Udinese. Juve now lead the table by 6 points. And Stefano Pioli has been sacked by Lazio after losing 4-1 to Roma in the derby. Simone Inzaghi, you may remember him, the former Lazio player, takes over as manager until the end of the season. And Zlatan Ibrahimovic scored a hat-trick for PSG in a 4-1 win over Nice. Worth noting, Hatem Ben Arfa scored as well in that game as he pushes to make France's Euro 2016 squad. OK, let's focus on Johan Cruyff now and speak to freelance football writer based in the Netherlands, Derek Brookman. Derek, thank you very much for joining us on the podcast.
Hey, you're welcome, Rob. Glad to be here.
So you're based in Eindhoven, so obviously you've seen a lot of the coverage since the death of Johan Cruyff at the age of 68. What has it been like? Has the coverage been sort of just everywhere since he passed away?
Absolutely. It's been on TV, in print media, obviously online, which is understandable because it's safe to say that he was, without a doubt, the best known Dutch person there was. So, you know, his death touched not just the football community, but everybody in this country, without a doubt.
Would you put him in the bracket of almost, and I did message you about this before, not just a footballing icon, but almost a pop icon, as in an icon of culture?
Yes, he seemed to embody the flamboyant 60s and early 70s in the Netherlands, when the culture that we know today was really taking shape. And he, more than anybody else, was the lightning rod for that. He challenged everything that he thought could be improved. Such was the man's talent that, in general, he did end up improving everything that he thought should be improved.
With Ajax in the 70s, he won 3 European Cups in a row as a player and scored in the final against Inter, I think, and was captain for the 3rd one. How pivotal was he to those successes, or was he in what was a great Ajax team?
Well, I think both are true. He was obviously in a great Ajax team, but I think it's debatable whether they would ever have reached the heights that they did without him, because even great teams need one special player really to, you know, to dig them out of a hole when things are going against them, or to pull them together. You know, and the thing about Cruyff is he was such a great communicator on the pitch when he was a player. So he wasn't just doing great things with the ball, but he was also getting the best out of players, telling them what to do, where to go. Unquestionably, without him, I don't think they'd have been the team that they were, and they certainly wouldn't have been as successful.
You talk about his nature to fight anything that he thinks can be improved, and we certainly saw in recent years with Barcelona a little bit of friction with the hierarchy there. Were there similar things for him within Dutch football, the Dutch Football Association, or Ajax in general?
Oh yes, I mean, one of his great quotes, I think, is that he said, "I don't know how it happens, but wherever I go, people divide into two camps, those who are for me and those who are against me, and they end up both arguing with me and with each other." So he acknowledges that this is what he does to people. He polarizes, but he doesn't really seem to bother too much. So, you know, everywhere he's gone, in Ajax, he had great struggles there trying to take, let's say, control of the direction of the club in 2010, which he obviously eventually won. He's had a lot of fallings out with the Dutch FA. Something that's often overlooked about him, which to me, in many ways, summarises the man's genius, is when his playing days came to an end at Ajax, when he was 36, he was in a contract dispute. They didn't want to give him a new contract. So he went and joined Feyenoord, which at the time it's unthinkable. You know, it's like Totti going to Lazio or Messi going to Real Madrid, you know, Henrik Larsson going to Rangers. Really, it's of that magnitude. He went to Feyenoord at 36 years of age, at a time where Feyenoord weren't really doing very well at all. The following season, they won the league and the cup under his tutelage. It was an extraordinary performance at that late stage in his career. It caused so much friction when he did it. But yet again, in the end, he was proved right.
We look back to what he did with Barcelona, and many will say he effectively transformed the culture of that football club, and is just as important to Barcelona as he is at Ajax. What is his legacy Ajax, Derek? How do people view that?
To this day, there's an ongoing debate about how Ajax should play. And for many, and this is the Cruyff way of thinking, it's an attacking style, 4-3-3. You're always playing with two wide men. You know, Frank de Boer, he's been criticised over the past few years. Ajax have been quite successful, but they haven't really been playing with a flair. All this is stemmed back from, like I said earlier, a kind of master plan that Cruyff had drawn up back in 2010 about the way forward for players through the youth system, the way the first team should play. So he always had a clear vision, like he did at Barcelona. He had the same thing for Ajax about how he thought the game should be played. He was very, very critical of the Dutch team in the last World Cup in Brazil, even though they got third place, because they were playing a 5-3-2, which he thought was just un-Dutch.
What about the cause for Ajax to rename their stadium? Derek, what do you think? What do you see happening with that? Do you see them naming that ground after Johan Cruyff?
It's a distinct possibility. Obviously, at the moment, there's a lot of emotional things being said, and maybe when the dust settles, somebody somewhere will decide that it's not such a good idea after all. But there's a huge groundswell of opinion here that wants that. I've heard, I believe, rumblings that the same thing is going on in Barcelona, where they're going to redevelop the Nou Camp, and there's maybe talk of renaming that in his name. So in the end, it may be a rush to see who can get there first.
All the Netherlands players are wearing the number 14 during their victory at Wembley last week. What do you say to the win for the Netherlands from that game, and what has been the reaction to a friendly victory at Wembley against an England side that had days before beaten the world champions? Has there been a swell of positivity to a Dutch national team that has largely been surrounded with negativity of late?
Yes, there is. It's a friendly, so there's only so much that you can take from these matches, but I think most people here were expecting a pretty heavy defeat. England are playing extremely well at the moment. And so for them, there was a lot of positives to be taken from it, especially, Vincent Janssen was playing his first match as centre-forward. Well, he scored one and set up the winner. People are hoping here that this could, again, be the start of a new dawn for the Dutch national team, because, I mean, really, the last 2 years, they have fallen so far, so fast, to not be going to the Euro 2016 when it's been expanded to 24 teams for the first time it really is heartbreaking for them. So, yes, I think that they'll try and take as much positive as they can from the result at Wembley. Hopefully build on it and go on from there.
Derek, thank you very much for joining us on the podcast. That's all we have time for on Football in Europe this week. If you do enjoy the show, please leave us a review on iTunes. And if you have any thoughts about what we've discussed this week, just tweet us at FIE Podcast, and we'll read those out on next Monday's show.
This is Football in Europe,